Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa Aparuta de sangamatasatavara ye soravanta bamunjantu sadang. So this is the observance night and half moon waning. Waning moon, and tomorrow's the equinox, autumn. And the year, last quarter of the year, 2000, it'll be history, like 1999 is now history, memory. We have just 3 weeks left of the Vasa. So these are perceptions of time, change on the conditioned realm of convention, like Vasa is a convention. The autumn, doesn't say I'm autumn, we call it autumn equinox. And so this is a convention that we use for communication, for say moral agreements or cultural attitudes that we all subscribe to or use for our conventional reality. And then Paramattha Satya is the ultimate reality where this is where we get in beyond the convention. We see conventions are made, they're made up, they're dependent on other things. Things that are considered good in one conventional form aren't considered appropriate in another, and so we have various biases and prejudices that we get through culture and through the conventions that we have. So just in living in Europe, isn't it? We have just the old biases of what French are like and Germans and Italians and so forth. We have, you know, cultural attitudes, that way of perceiving these things. So we form these various opinions, views. That's why it's easy to have like ethnic warfare and race prejudices and class snobbery and so forth, because we never question the conventional reality that we've adopted. We just go along with it. So then we hold, you know, various views about our religion and our race and our culture and compare it to somebody else's. And then on that level, then there's nothing but, you know, we have ideals now, say, of democracy and equality and all that, but we're still very much influenced by the conventional realities that we're conditioned by. It takes quite a determined effort to get beyond your cultural conditioning. Like being, American, you think, you know, you think brought up in a there's a lot that you just assume, make assumptions from. Like I never realized how arrogant I could be till I had to live in another culture. Or I never saw how, you know, how the American idealism could be another blind spot. You know, it could be like shoving our ideas down everybody's throat, saying America knows what's good for everybody, how they should run their countries. And yet when you're brought up to think that's, you know, we are somehow the most advanced and so forth, then that's an assumption. That I don't think that was taught in any intentional way. It was assumed. It was an underlying attitude. So, but when you to get beyond these assumptions, things we pick up, and if we don't even know that we have these attachments, till they're reflected in some way. These biases. So that's why living in different cultures, isn't it, helps for one thing. You know, you find. Like going to live in Thailand helped me to see a lot of these things because the culture was so different. And then the whole attitude was in living in a Buddhist monastery, so the emphasis was on reflection, mindfulness and wisdom. So I just wasn't becoming a kind of ersatz Thai or, going native, as they say. But it was learning to see what, you know, the subtleties of attitude and assumption that one is conditioned by, that may not be all that easily seen until you find yourself suffering about something. One of the problems that we have in even meditation is this kind of compulsiveness. Our society is we're brought up to be very kind of obsessed and compulsive. There's so many shoulds when you're coming from ideas. From ideas and ideals, and there's the result of that is always there's so many shoulds in your vocabulary, how things should be. And so it's this idealism is, you know, has its beauty, not to discard it, but to recognize its limitation, that this feeling that there's always something we've got to do. There's something we haven't done yet that we should be doing. We should be working harder than we're working. We should be practicing more than we're practicing. We should be more honest than we are. We should be more open. We should be more devout. We should be better natured and on and on. Like this. All these are true, you know, the shoulds are usually right. You know, in terms of, you know, if things were perfect, then I would be, you know, everything would be just perfect, you know. I'd be an ideal, and life, society would be ideal. Amaravati would fit the ideal, we'd all be perfect. And so then there's nothing more you should do because you've already reached the top. But that's not the way life is. An idea is something we create, isn't it? It's like you take your ideas from the best or what's the most kind of beautiful or perfect or fair or just. So the Buddha is pointing to the way life is, the way it is, which is its changingness. It doesn't stick at the best, doesn't it? You can't hold anything. And as best, you're contemplating flowers, for example, you know, like roses. You get perfect rose, which is just at its peak, you know, it's just absolutely perfect in its form, its color, its fragrance. But you can't keep it that way. You know, it lasts that way very briefly, and suddenly it all starts going the other way. And then you just want to get rid of it, throw it out and get another one. So, like with mindfulness, we're aware of this changingness, the way things change. And therefore, in terms of our own experience, their meditation, being aware of how things change, like moods and feelings. When we think of how things should be, then we get back into ideas again, and then compare ourselves to maybe ideas that we have. What practice is? What good practice is? How many hours a day you should sit in meditation? How you should do this? How you should do that? And on like this, to where we can operate from these ideas that, you know, which are oftentimes very good ideas. But the problem, even if you perform according to all the shoulds, there's always something more. There's always something, it should be better than this, or it goes on. You never get to the root of the problem, because you just go on and on there's always this feeling there's something more you've got to do, something you should be doing. And when we reach the end of this, then we'd give up sometimes. You think, I just had enough of this. To hell with it. I'm just going to enjoy life. You know, I'm just going to disrobe and just go out and have a good time and eat, drink, make merry till I die. It's because one can only be driven so far, and then it just you can't sustain it. You know, it doesn't work anymore. So listen to, like, should is a fair enough, you know, way to think about something. Some people think we shouldn't even think should. but to recognize how things affect us, you know, like just noticing the feeling, there's always something more I have to do. Right? For example, that story about this recurring dream I used to have when I first went to stay with Lungpo Cha. And I'd been in 1963, I finished my master's degree in Berkeley, and that was a year of just really compulsive and intense studying, where everything I couldn't enjoy anything, because every time I went out and try to enjoy myself, I kept thinking, oh, you've got your exam coming, you know, you've got to pass your master's degree, and so, you know, go to a party or try to relax, and then this voice would say, you shouldn't be here. You know, you've got to take this exam, and you're not ready, you're not good enough for it. And so, you know, that whole year I couldn't enjoy anything, I was just kind of driving myself. And after I finished the master's, I couldn't read a book for about 6 months after that. My mind just wouldn't concentrate. I just couldn't. I went through Peace Corps training in Hawaii after that, and they wanted me to read all these things. I couldn't read them. I couldn't even read the instructions. And it's just like overloaded, you know. But that left a kind of intensity of the way I would approach anything would be either can't do it and just give up totally or get into the old compulsive mode. So then when I, you know, when I went to stay with Lungpo Cha, I kept having this recurring dream because I put a lot of effort into my practice, meditation practice. This dream would I'd be going into like a cafe or some coffee shop. I'd sit down, order a cup of coffee, and you know, nice pastry, and then the voice would say, "You shouldn't be here. You should be studying for the exam." And so that would be the kind of recurring theme of the dream. And this dream kept, you know, it was, well, I'd have it quite often. It wasn't one off. And I kept thinking, what's it telling me? And then my compulsive mind kept thinking, there's something I'm not doing that I should be doing. You know, I should be practicing more. I should be more mindful. I should be, I shouldn't be sleeping so much. I wasn't sleeping hardly at all, actually. I kept thinking that this was a message telling me that somehow, you know, there's something I'm doing that I'm not doing that I should be doing. And so I kept trying to think, what could it be? You know, I can't drive myself any more than what I'm doing, and you know, it just. Couldn't figure it out. And then one morning I had this dream, I woke up and then I had the answer. And the answer was, there wasn't any examination. I just realized, then I'd lived my life always like I was going to be tested or brought before the authorities and put to a test, and that I was never ready. I mean, never good enough. There's always more. I could study more. I could read more. I could do things more. I shouldn't be lazy, and I shouldn't enjoy life because this is wasting my time because the exam's coming and I'm not ready for it. And it was a whole kind of emotional conditioning that I'd acquired because the school systems in the States are very competitive. You start when you're 5 years old and you just keep going. So once I saw that this was had that insight that there wasn't any, that I just thought there was, and I had always lived my life, most of my life, in this attitude that there was going to be a big test that I wasn't prepared for. And maybe it was also from my religious background, where you're going to be tested when you die. You go to the gates, and then whether they let you in or not, you know, whether you've been good enough to go to heaven or you have to go down to hell. You know, so there's always this sense of you've got to do something. You're not good enough. I'm imperfect. I have too many faults. I've got to get rid of them. I've got to become something that I'm not. The way I am is not good enough. And so that this driven quality, bringing it into monastic life, you know, I could do it for a while, but then I realized that if I was going to be a monk, I didn't want to have to live. You know, that wasn't the purpose of the life. And it wasn't meant to be that way. It was just how I was just interpreting monasticism with this compulsive problem. So I stopped having the dream once I got the answer to the riddle. So then, thinking, you know, when you really contemplate the Dhamma, and like this morning I was talking about the first three fetters, like Sakkayaditti, the personality view. We acquire this when we're born. We're not born with a personality view, isn't it? It's something we acquire. And of course you can see when you're brought up in a very competitive system, you see yourself in terms of the comparing yourself to others and to ideals all the time. Your value, your worth is very much related to what's considered the best and who's the best. And so if you don't fit into the best category, then you sometimes see yourself in terms of, you know, not being good enough. And even people who I used to think were the best don't usually think of themselves as the best. Sometimes we think some people are much happier than because we project onto them. We think they're better off than we are. But when the Buddha emphasized mindfulness as the way, then this is pointing to the way things are rather than to the best. So when they used to read these in the morning in Wat Pa Pong, they'd have reading, they'd read these excerpts from suttas about, you know, what a bhikkhu should be, and they were all according to the ideals of what a good bhikkhu is. And so, you know, this was how to interpret this, because they're wanting to be the feeling of having to live up to such high standards. Also was a feeling of, you know, can I really do all that? You know, is it, one can just feel so kind of discouraged or despairing because you're looking at it in terms of ideals. But then the teaching of the Buddha isn't based on ideals, but on Dhamma, the way things are. I mean, like in Vipassana, you're really, you know, tuning in to impermanence, to transiency, to anicca, which it's not a matter of how things should be; it's the way they are. Isn't it? All conditioned phenomena is impermanent. There's not like conditioned phenomena should be impermanent. It is. So it's opening to impermanence. It's not trying to project this idea onto life, but it's a different using your intuitive mind, isn't it? You open, you watch, you listen, you pay attention, and then you're aware of the changingness. And you're aware of even your own compulsive attitude, like being aware of this compulsive feeling. There's something I gotta do it. And being aware of that. That awareness of that feeling, of that compulsive feeling. Or aware the attitude that I thought was being quite honest and realistic, that I'm a person with a lot of faults and weaknesses, and that in order to become an enlightened being, I've got to, you know, get over these and get rid of them in some way, and become an arhat. So then, this is how the mind works, and this is how it's often, you know, how you read it into the scriptures. But in terms of reflective awareness, you know, when you really notice that is something you've created in your mind. I am a person with a lot of faults and weaknesses, and I've got to practice hard in order to overcome them. That's something I'm creating in my mind. I'm creating that attitude. I create that. That's not the truth. that is the creation. And that which is aware of that, then you start beginning to know the difference between the awakened state of being and what you create into your mind through habit, through attachment. So like in listening, the one who knows, when you, like we use this Bhutto, or the name Buddha itself is a significant word, because it's putting us into that state, pointing to a state of attention, of knowing directly, of intuitive awareness, of wisdom. So there's no person, you know, say, you know, if you start thinking, I'm Buddha, then that's coming from personality again. Identity, and thinking I am the Buddha, and that's another, that doesn't work. But we call refuge in Buddha, or Bhutang Sarangachami, gives us that's a kind of convention too, but it points to a reality that we can begin to trust in, which is awareness. Because the Buddha is the Bhutto, the one who knows, that which knows, which is awake and aware. And it's awakeness. It's not judgment, judgmental, critical. The Buddha isn't saying you should be like this and you shouldn't be like that and all that. It's knowing that the all conditioned phenomena is like this, it's changing. Where sometimes we brought up in a religion like Christianity, where God tells you what you should be. And at least this is my the way I was taught, you know, how you should be a good boy, and that every time you're bad, you hurt God's feelings. I was brought up to think that. If I told a lie, you know, God would be very, you know, disappointed in me. And so you always, you know, this is kind of a moral training as a child. Really, it's what your parents think, isn't it? It's all mixed up with perception of parents and God is a kind of parental figure. So awakeness then is learning to listen and to trust in just the most simple state of being. It's not like jhana or absorption in anything. It's pure attention. And so it is pure. If you trust in this purity, then there are no faults in purity, is there? It's perfect. There's no, if it's pure, there's no impurities. So this is where to trust in this attentiveness to the present. Because once you try to find it, it's pure, you know, then you start going into doubt, you know. So don't trust it rather than think about it. Just in the imminent act of being awake, attentive in this moment. So in this, when I do this, then my mind relaxes into this. I hear the sound of silence and then there's no self, there's purity, there's no self. And if I start feeling, now if the conditions arise around, I should be doing something, I'm aware of it. I'm aware of it as the condition, the viparka kama, of having been through the American educational system and driven myself to this incredibly compulsive way of doing living one's life. So the vipaka kama arises, you know, you should be and shouldn't be and all that. But in this state of purity and of pure attention. It's not personal. I'm not saying I'm pure now. Ajahn Sumedho's pure. It's beyond that. It's not a personal, you're not talking about it in any personal way, but it's a recognition, a realization. It's what you really are. It's the true nature of things. It's not a creation. I'm not creating the purity. I'm not kind of creating an ideal of it and then deluding myself with it. But this is where it is trusting, because your personality view is not going to trust it. Your personality is going to come and say, nothing pure about you. You know, you just had some dirty thoughts, and you were, you know, really looking pretty, you know, really feeling pretty upset and angry about something somebody said to you the other day. And what kind of, you're certainly full of impurities. You know, you're not, after all these years, you're still filled with impurities. And this is the old inner tyrant. This is the personality view. Personality view is the tyrant, is the victim, is the victimizer. It's poor me, I'm so impure, and it's the accuser, you are not good enough, you're impure. It's both. No, you can't trust it. Don't take refuge in being a victim or in being a victimizer. That you can trust in this awakened awareness. And that trust is humbling. It isn't like believing in something, but it's learning to relax and be. Trust in just the ability to just be here and open and receptive to this, whatever is happening now, even if what's happening is unpleasant or nasty or whatever the conditions you're experiencing are. The present is not the that's not a problem if you trust in this impurity. Like with the vinaya, for example, the idea of trying to keep the vinaya pure, and because the whole personality view attaches to even the vinaya. Am I pure enough in this? And my vinaya is purer than somebody else's, or not as pure, and on like that. Then you're just using this convention to increase the sense of personal worth or worthlessness. So if you think you're more pure than the rest, that's arrogant. Holier than thou, and then if you think you're always impure, then you know you're going to feel hopeless. You know, you just feel can't do it. Better to go and get drunk or something. At least forget about it for a while. Relax and have a good time. Always than beating yourself up by your ideals of not being pure enough. Conventions themselves are limited. You know, their nature is imperfect and changing. So, in our convention, you know, maybe you expect even the convention to be perfect, and then when you become, after a while, you can become very critical of the convention because you can see flaws in it, or it isn't, you know, isn't as good as you thought, or some of it doesn't make sense. Or things like this. But recognize that the convention isn't, you know, it's anicca, dukkha, anatta, just like every other convention. But it is a convention based on say, morality, doing good and refrain from doing evil with action and speech. So it's an agreed way of living where we agree to take responsibility for how we live in this planet, on this society. The convention we have, like Theravada Buddhism, is, you know, you can find many things you may not like or find all that agreeable to you, but it is a tradition. There's, you know, a lot of power from being so old and ancient and still useful. You know, it's still a viable tradition that works. I mean, it's not a matter of it having to be perfect for us to use, but learning to use it for awakened awareness. Then we get into the old Buddhist context, like the Mahayana, and then Vajrayana, and the Hinayana, and then you think, we're considered Hinayana, lesser vehicle. And we think, that means it's probably not as good. Mahayana is better. Logic, isn't it? Lesser vehicle, and greater vehicle than the Vajrayana, and that's the absolute, the best. You can't get better than Vajra, according to the Tibetans. That's the highest vehicle. So that then we start thinking in terms of good, better, best. And but all of these are conventions, you know, whether it's, you call it Mahayana, Hinayana, Vajrayana, they're conventions. They're limited. They're imperfect. They're functional. To use them because they for mindfulness rather than for some kind of attachment or position that one takes on anything. So they can be very divisive if we attach to Theravada and then we start looking down on every other form of Buddhism. And then we think they're Mahayana or they're not the pure. They're not the original. They're higher or greater, but not original. And we can get arrogant because we've got our own way of justifying our convention. But this is all just playing with words, isn't it? When you look right at what's going on, you're just creating Mahayana, Hinayana, Vajrayana in your mind. Because the refuge is in Buddha, not in these yanas. And the Buddha knows that every thought, anything is changing and non-self. So trust in that, in the simplicity of that, rather than, because if you don't, then it is going to arouse your old compulsive habits of thinking, I've got to do more, I've got to develop this, I've got to become a bodhisattva, I've got to get the higher practice going, I've got to, and on like that. And so it just, the whole, when you're caught in that conventional realm, and that's all you know, then you're easily intimidated and blinded by all the dazzling kind of positions and attitudes and ideas that people can throw at you. So this is where trusting in awareness, and then you, not a matter of having the best, but of feeling that maybe you should have something better than what you have. That's a creation of your mind, isn't it? When you establish, like in terms of what is adequate, like for monasticism, Buddhist monasticism, it's not based on having the best, but on what's adequate. Are the four requisites adequate? You don't have to be the best. You don't have to have the best food and the best robes and all that. But adequate. good enough? Is it survival? Is there any problem having a place to stay or medicine for sickness? It doesn't have to be the very best. But it's, in fact, the standard is oftentimes established at the lowest point, like rag robes rather than silk robes. Then the Dhamma, Dhamma Vinaya, is respected and taught. So these are things that are very, which give us a sense of whether, it's a place we can live. Standards aren't placed at the best. It has to be the very best. But if the Dhamma is taught and the Vinaya is respected, the four requisites are adequate. It's good enough. So go for the practice rather than quibble around the rest. Now, whether you like the teacher or not, or whether it's better to use the awareness to develop awareness rather than to go along with one's feelings of criticism or doubts and problems with dealing with the people and the place you're in. I was, just contemplated in myself this compulsive attitude until I really could see it. I must. And it was very insidious because it wasn't just a one-time off insight, but it was reminded myself of how this is more or less how I approach life in general, full of shoulds and feelings there's something I've got to do, I should be doing something, or I shouldn't. And just noticing, listening to this, and learning to relax and trust in the refuge, which is very humbling because it doesn't seem like anything. It's not like, it seems like it's not worth anything. And it doesn't seem like anything much. So say, just attention in the present. So what? I want something I should be doing. Tell me what to do next. How many hours should I be sitting? How many hours should I be walking? And what should I be developing? Should I do more metta and more like this? Because we want something to do. And we feel very ill at ease when there's nothing to do, nowhere to go. So in monastic life, we do offer structure, isn't it? If you have conventions and structures, you have morning puja, evening puja, and then you've got fortnightly recitations and so forth. So you have a form, conventional form to you. To do something. And then chanting and bindabhata and all these things are some part of a tradition. So it gives, but from this structure, It's to help us to observe, like sila for behavior, and the structure for a community. Or say when people go on the self retreat, then they kind of let go of the structure, then they're thrown onto their own. And what happens when you're left on your own? Nobody knows what you're doing. So you don't have to kind of look around, see if senior monks looking at you and on like that, you know. You're left to your own devices, so you could sleep all day, or you could, you know, read novels, or go for long walks, and or you could, you know, really practice hard, and or, you know, there's all different range of possibilities that's left up to you, and to notice that feeling of you know, when the structures remove, what happens. And not in a judgmental way, like they'll bring back the should, like I should practice so many hours a day, sit so many hours, walk so many hours, and do this and do that in order to, you know, get my practice, get my samadhi, and really get somewhere in my practice. And that, not that that's wrong, but that can be, you know, that's also maybe a very compulsive thing, and if you don't live up to it, then what do you feel like? You know, do you feel guilt-ridden if you don't do what you've determined to do? And to notice how the mind works, and awaken to it. It's easy if you have a strong leader that says, oh, now you do this, and you do that, and you, everybody come, and everybody leave, and everybody, you know, march in step, and so forth, and this is good training also. But that also brings up, now, some people that don't like it, then they start, they're resisting, rebelling against it. Or other people love it because they can't, they don't know what to do if nobody's telling them what to do next. They don't know how to operate. And they like the security of everything controlled and everything held together by a strong leader. But recognize that this monastic life, the thing is for awakening. And a strong leader or nobody else can make you do it. You know, I can kind of browbeat you into conformity, you know, get heavy and kind of browbeat you into, or manipulate you emotionally by saying, if you really want to please me, you will do this. If you really want my approval, I won't give you my approval if you don't behave properly and things like this, then I can kind of use my emotional power to try to control and manipulate the situation, but that's not something that, you know, is skillful. That's not what we're here for. The onus is on each one of us, isn't it? Is waking up, and only that's. But don't think I have to wake up because Ajahn Sumedho said. But learning to recognize and appreciate in yourself just a simple, imminent act of attention, open, relaxed listening, being here and now, just learning to recognize that, to appreciate that more and more and trust it. Because you're emotionally probably programmed for the other. The you should and you shouldn't. So wanting to give an occasion a situation, opportunity, encouragement, all this is, you know, like what we're trying to do here, just, you know, give the a situation where you're encouraged to trust in this. And to cultivate this way. When we say cultivate, they're not, that's not like having to do anything, it's learning more to relax and trust in being. The flow of life. Because we are, you know, life is like this, and so life changes, you know, we can see just in the past year how the changes at Amaravati, from its building and opening ceremony and all the kind of ambience around that, and now it's that period's over. It's changed. Difference like this. I remember, you know, just in with Wat Pa Pong, just feeling when I first went there, it was such a kind of esprit de corps. You know, we were really there with Lungpo Cha. There's only 22 monks, and we were, you know, we were really getting somewhere, and we were really crack troops, top grade, top guns. And then a few years later, you know, seeing things I didn't like and getting very critical of it and thinking it's all falling apart. And then I saw it fall apart with Lungpo Cha when he had his stroke. And I remember going to, a few years after he had his stroke, going to Wat Pa Pong. And in Wat Pa Pong, they had the inner monastery where the monks lived. Then they had an outer part where they had a special kind of kuti set up for Lungpo Cha, which was allowed for nursing care and all kinds of things. And they had an outer sala where people come. So you go to the outer sala and nobody wanted to come to the monastery. All they came to see was Lungpo Cha, who was ill and couldn't talk or do anything. All the emphasis was in his kuti, and then no monks wanted to live there, and I remember going in, there were only three monks one time in the huge monastery. Ajahn Liam and two others. And the place was looking pretty shabby, and it was usually spick and span and clean, and it, you know, the standards of order were very high there, and it was sweeping the paths and repairing everything. And then suddenly you go and it's like a ghost town, you know, just the cooties, the empty cooties that need repairing and are dirty and dusty and the paths not swept and so forth. And I remember some Bangkok people coming to me and saying, oh, it's no good anymore, Ajahn Liam can't teach, he's no... And they complain, they say, we want you to come back and be the abbot. They're thinking I should go back and take over. But they wanted, you know, the people were just, you know, real, you know, it had changed in a way that they just felt it shouldn't be like that. But now it's back into its you know, 50 monks and it's all, you know, it's all operating in full capacity. But I mean, it's changes, things change. Now are we open to change? We're not demanding that it change in any way that we want it, or that when it's at its peak that we can keep it at that peak. It's impossible. So that, and even in yourself, you know, to be aware when you're at your best, when you're at your worst, when you're feeling really good and inspired and love the life, and when you're feeling down and despairing, lonely and depressed and disheartened, These are this awareness is your refuge, where the changingness of feeling, of attitude, of mood, but of material change, of emotional change. Then stay with that, because the refuge is indestructible. You know, it's not something that changes. It's something you can, it's a refuge you can trust in. But that refuge is not something you create. It's not a creation. It's not an ideal. It's very practical and very simple, but easily overlooked or not noticed. So when you're mindful, you're beginning to notice like this. Like when I remind myself, this is pure, this moment. And I really make a note of this. This is the path, this is purity. Not anything I'm creating, but this state of attention, of relaxed, not attention like a tung, but it's more like relaxed attention. Listening, open, receptive. And as you relax into that, then it's a natural state, not a created state, it's not dependent on conditions making it that way. It's just, we forget it. There's a problem, we forget it all the time, so we get thrown back into the old habits every time. This is why with mindfulness you're remembering it more, trusting it more. Then it's cultivating this, in this way of just leading yourself back all the time, right to this awareness. And then you get carried away again and then forgot again. And keep doing that. And no matter how recalcitrant or difficult or wild your emotions and thoughts may be, all right, you know, this is the refuge. And to apply that to everything, you know, being personally wounded, like when somebody says something very hurtful, like a question, what is it that gets hurt? If somebody insults me or abuses me in some way, I feel hurt, I feel misunderstood, and I feel offended and annoyed or even angry. What is it that gets angry and annoyed and gets offended, you know? Is that my refuge? That which whose feelings get hurt and gets offended and gets upset? If I'm in this refuge, the refuge never gets upset by anything. You can call it anything you want. But as a person, then I can be easily upset. As a person, you can upset me very easily. So, I mean, because the personality, the sakyanditti is like that, you know, it's based on, you know, me is worthwhile or worthy of being, you know, appreciated or not appreciated and being understood properly or misunderstood or respected or I'm not respected enough or, you know, all this kind of thing. I'm just, then my personality is, I'm just, you know, wide open to be hurt, to be offended, to be upset by anything. But that's not my personality is not my refuge. It's not what I would advise as being a refuge. Because it, if your personality is anything like mine, it I wouldn't for a minute want to recommend even you taking refuge in my personality. But in awareness, yes. Because awareness is pure and it doesn't, you know, if you trust it more and more, then you're, even though you're feeling hurt and upset and disrespected and unloved and unappreciated, the awareness knows that it's anicca. It's not judging, it's not making any problem, it's just fully accepting the feeling of nobody loves me, everybody hates me feeling. And that goes, it goes away naturally, it drops because its nature is change. So this evening, we have, this is the midnight hour, isn't it? So everybody's invited to join in the observance.